Hello, fellow Star Trek fans. Welcome back to a brand new episode of The War Room, brought to you as part of the Clone Star podcast. I am your host, Mike Overton, and joining me in the co-host seat this week is my wonderful friend from Ireland, Joseph Hurley. Sho, how are you?
Mike, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Now, our guest this week, we are delighted to welcome a man behind all the makeup. You might not recognize him, but you do know him. He's been a Klingon, multiple Kelpians, a Tellarite, but we know him most as the wonderful Saurian Linus on Star Trek Discovery. We are delighted to be joined by David Benjamin Tomlinson. David, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to meet you both and be here.
Thank you. I have to say, Linus is one of those characters that I laugh at, but in a funny way. I don't mean to laugh at him in a derogatory way, because I love Linus. It's just the fact he randomly pops up in all of these weird and wonderful places.
It's been curious to watch people react to Linus, and I think everyone is on side with, we laugh with Linus because in some way we all identify with him. Like, I know in that episode where he was jumping around and unable to figure out the new technology, like anytime there's an Instagram update or like an Apple update, I'm just like, wait, what? I just figured I'm not an easy adapter. And so that whole storyline with Linus totally spoke to me. And I know we all love our sci-fi heroes to be easy adapters to new things, but I think there's a large percentage of us who aren't. And I think that's our way into Linus. Like, we all identify. He's good at his job, but
He just doesn't do technology.
Yeah. So
what you're saying is there's a lot of Linus in you. That's what you're saying.
There is a lot of Linus in me. Yeah, for sure.
David, I have to ask you a question straight out. Every time I see your name on social media and even here on the Zoom chat, it says David Benjamin Tomlinson. Why do you keep the name Benjamin in your name so prominently?
I've been on a bit of a journey with my name. When I started getting my stage legs at the beginning of my career, I was doing a lot of comedy. And as a teenager, I was very tortured and over-serious, and I insisted everyone call me David. It's David. And then when I started doing comedy, I was like, David's not a comedic name. So it was like Dave. You know, Dave Tomlinson, he's the guy you want to watch in that improv troupe or watch that sketch show with that Dave Tomlinson guy. And then when I kind of sort of transitioned out of comedy and into theater, I noticed that there was I had a bit of trouble shaking off this, oh, you just are a funny person. That's all that you are. That's all that you do. And I decided that I wanted to embrace all of myself. Like, if I have these three names, if my parents gave me these three names, then my goal was to embody all of that. And so I just said, this is my best step forward, is to embody all of this, all of these letters, and see where it takes me.
So is this like a kind of a Clark Kent / Superman kind of thing? When you take off your glasses, it's Dave Tomlinson. When the glasses are on, it's David Benjamin Tomlinson.
It's actually kind of a reverse Clark Kent, because when I take off my glasses, I stop being able to see you. And then now this is my...
It's not like that's important. I mean...
So Dave, hang on a second. I'm curious that we've got comedy, stand-up comedy, we've got theater and all this. There's a hell of a lot going on. Going all the way back to the start, did you grow up in a creative household, or where was the kind of spark of creativity that kind of, you know, grabbed you when you were smaller?
I was a very creative child. I didn't necessarily grow up in a creative environment, but I had a very immediate and intuitive connection with creativity. And so it was always with me. It showed up in how I played with other kids. It was always games of let's pretend, or for a long time with one of my best childhood friends, we would make these radio tapes on like audio cassette, and we just make these crazy horror movies and silly.
He's done it, Mike. He's
I know, I just did it.
He did it. Sip. He's done it. Audio cassettes. Oh my god,
we're all out. Done it.
Well, at least that's out of the way now. At least, at least that is not on top of us anymore.
your so your radio dramas and audio cassettes.
Yeah, so and I wrote proofs a lot as a kid. So creativity has always been my wingman throughout my entire life. Growing up gay and closeted and in a rural environment, I kind of went through a period of pretty intense self-loathing and didn't really think I could or should pursue the things that I loved, which sort of prevented me from at an earlier age, really going down that path. So it was something I kept very private. And then when I started reconciling myself and venturing out into the world, things really, my creative gifts kind of exploded. And then I found my way in through comedy and improv and sketch, and that turned into theater and indie theater. And all the time I'm writing and creating things, and have a really interesting developed a really interesting skill set along the way that's varied and very unique. And then when I had the opportunity to try prosthetics, it was like this amazing intersection of all of these weird gifts that I had acquired along the way. It's like I didn't know what I was preparing myself for. And then here's this opportunity. And then we've had this amazing journey of the last 5 years.
I'm curious, have you, because I listened to Anson Mount's podcast, The Well, a good few years ago, and I remember him talking about the fact that he did stand-up comedy as well. Now, he said it was absolutely disastrous. I'm just curious, did you mention to him that you had been a stand-up comic as well? And
No.
also, I have to ask you this question, David. What was
Yeah.
your best stand-up routine? Because you're going to have to tell us a really good joke on this podcast now.
Okay, well my when I did stand up, my stand up always was a comedic story. Like it was always narrative. It was not like set up punchline. So it was like a 15-minute hilarious misadventure from my life. And a lot of my solo work now is storytelling from my life. And so it's less, this is hilarious, here's a funny, it's more like this is a hilarious story and we can relate because we all go through this thing. So it's hard to tell you my best bit because I'd have to tell you a 15-minute story for it to pay off. But I never spoke with Anson about it. I actually did not know that about Anson.
Well, there you go. Now that's a random fact about Anson that you didn't know. So it's something that the
I'm
next
going
time
to tick that on my podcast box,
you.
bingo card, random facts.
And like in terms of say, like what you were saying, say in terms of like your growth and things like that and how you're embracing things, how much of kind of a, say, how much did it take for you to say, stand up in front of a crowd and say, I'm going to tell as kind of a story about my life, things that I have done, and I'm going to try and put a comedic spin onto it. Because the first time you did it, it must have been absolutely terrifying. Or did you just take like a duck to water and say, no, this is actually, I'm talking about my life, my experiences, and I've no problem doing that?
A little bit of both, actually. There's a lot of ownership you feel about talking about your own experience. And the thing that was driving me to do it was because I wasn't seeing that reflected everywhere. Like, when I was in the sketch and improv scene, I was one of two queer performers. So I wasn't seeing like my experience represented. And so I was sort of driven to like, this stuff needs to be talked about too, and this stuff needs to be expressed. But at the same time, it's harrowing to get up there and be like, I'm gonna talk to you about this very personal but hilarious, always hilarious, this very hilarious thing. But you realize, like, for years I had a very funny story about getting crabs. My first experience with getting crabs, which was a horrendous experience, but it always plays like gangbusters because we can all relate to it. And it was a ridiculous story. It was a ridiculous, ridiculous story. But it was like, yes, I'm talking about this and we can laugh at it. And then in a way, we're all free from it, what we might feel about it. Like all the shame or the, oh, this happened. It's like, no, this is ridiculous and hilarious. And that's sort of like how I try to approach life.
And do you mind me asking, like, again, like, I'm not going to lie to you, David. I would have no capability to ever stand in front of a crowd and try and do what you've done. Was there any nights where it just didn't land, where the jokes were just completely dead on arrival and no one seemed to kind of get into it?
Yeah, as I was doing a lot of sketch and works like solo behind a mic, I would go to these comedy nights and I would tell my stories, and some of them had dramatic elements to them. And there was one monologue I used to do where I would stand naked in front of the crowd, kind of cupping my genitalia. And the whole monologue was about, I'm having a nightmare that I'm naked in front of a crowd of people. So it was very meta. And it just basically spoke to that experience of that we all, those nightmares that we have, and then I'm embodying it. And there are serious elements to that monologue. And so this crowd was particularly silent for whatever reason. A silent crowd isn't necessarily a crowd that's not with you. They're just listening.
They're just shocked that you're standing up on stage.
Yeah, they're shocked. And they're also like, some crowds really enjoy it, but are just very quiet. They're not big laughers. And in this silent patch, when I'm sort of going through one of the more serious moments of the monologue, I hear a woman's voice from the audience say something like, well, I thought this was a comedy show. And I was like, all right. Fair point. It was kind of like a really good motivator for me to be like, maybe I can't do the things that I want to be doing in the box of comedy, and maybe I have to take it to other places. I'm proud to stand firmly between those two poles, the comedy and the drama. Like, I've built a house for myself in between. Mm-hmm. I think there's value in both things, and I like to incorporate both in what I do. But sometimes there were those nights, and I still hear that woman's voice. It's gonna haunt me for the rest of my life. But
so whoever you are, you've haunted him for life.
Yes, way to go, lady.
The good thing is, we've actually got the name of David's autobiography in years to come. David Benjamin Tomlinson. I thought this was going to be a comedy show. Here it is. My God, publishers,
you buy that.
The title of the book right there.
Not the title of the autobiography. That's another slot on my bingo card. Amazing.
Listen, I'm getting royalties for that name when that book comes out.
100%. I mean, no, artists, we help each other out. We share. We we're a team.
In terms of stand-up comedy, were you still just kind of focused on stand-up comedy, or did you say at some point, listen, I want to go into the theater, or was this woman the prompt to say, fuck this, I'm out of this, I got to go into the theater?
It was a shot across my bow. It was, I sort of interpreted it as, oh, maybe I'm starting to be suffocated. Maybe people want a very specific thing. And maybe I want to do more than that. And I have to start creating agency for myself to be able to do more than that and not be like baffling to people. So, you know, I started doing improv, and that led to writing and performing sketch, and that led to writing and performing small plays, and really getting a taste for the dovetail of the joyful and the serious. And, you know, I had a really formative experience when I was a kid, and I was on the school bus going to school. And no one had sort of hassled me on the bus that day, which was pretty standard. So I was having kind of a great day. Like, no one had, you know, shoved me or said anything. And I was sitting in my seat, and I was like, I'm on top of the world, you know? And we passed a funeral home, and there was a procession of cars in the driveway, and people like standing beside their cars, clearly upset. And I said to myself, oh, it's all happening at the same time. Like, my best day can be someone else's worst day. And there's a marriage there of experience. And so it's joyful and it's sad all at the same time. And that, it felt like theater, I could explore that more. They were more willing to go there in theater than they were in comedy. So.
And what are some of the kind of performances in theater that you've enjoyed most so far?
That I have done?
Yep. See, we don't ask the easy questions here, David.
Now you're asking me to like, you know, pick among my children.
Again, as we said, not an easy podcast to be on.
That's you know, maybe that's the title of your autobiography. Not an easy podcast. The way I operate is I am massively in love with everything that I do at that time. And then when I stop doing that thing, I have to move on to something different and fall in love with something different. I just debuted a new solo show last summer called Fagnificent, which is addresses
I saw the things on Instagram, yes. About it. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about it. Yeah.
It's all about addressing middle-aged gay guy and all of the shenanigans that go on there. I wrote a play a number of years ago called Gash, which celebrated the hag horror genre, which I don't know if you're familiar with, but it's the micro genre of movies that was kicked off by Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, basically psychotic older women out of control, which I have a huge affinity for that genre. And there's, you know, I did a play. I'm just saying the things that are coming to mind. I did a play with a sort of iconic Toronto playwright named Skye Gilbert several years ago called Taller, which was a celebration of Taller Cranston, the Canadian figure skater who was an Olympian from many years ago. And that was a profound performance experience. And that was, you know, mirthful and.
But David, the way you're kind of talking about it, you just said, I wrote my own play last year and I performed it. It's like yes. You're talking about it like it's the most easiest thing in the world. Like, how did you kind of come about kind of, you know, as you developed yourself and things like that, how can you say, like, how hard is it to kind of sit down and say, you know what, I'm just going to write a play. I'm just going to write it. I'm going to perform it. I'm going to just do it. Like, for most of us, like, that's absolutely incredible to, like, even consider. But you've done it and you've done it more than once.
Honestly, creativity and the expression of creativity has been a guiding principle in my life. Creativity is my great faith, and it is the place I come from, and it is the place I will one day return to. And I have a large amount of discipline, which you need as an artist, but when an idea comes in the room, I treat them like people. Sit down, talk to me about who you are, talk to me about where we might go together and forge a relationship. And I'm kind of possessed and compelled to operate that way. I don't know that I have a choice not to do it. It's just instinctive, and I believe in the work of it, and I believe in the merit of it. And that's kind of the bedrock of my artistic practice. You know, the first screenplay that I wrote, no one is ever going to see. Right? It lives in the back of my file drawer, but it might be the most important screenplay I've ever written because it's the thing that taught me how to write a screenplay.
Why haven't you done anything with it?
Because it's terrible.
But like a true artist, you know that it's terrible and you just get out of it.
Yeah. But the writing of the screenplay and the working out how to do it is the thing that then enabled me to write more and pitch other screenplays, which I continue to do. And the same goes with TV series. I mean, the thing that separates an artist, a practicing artist from a non-practicing artist, is simply the moment where you say, I'm going to do the thing. It's just a matter of doing it. I'd love to do that. Then do it. In that moment, do it.
Like,
open the... What's the word?
Like, outside of, like, you know, you've been in shows like, you know, Queer as Folk, or From Black, Designated Survivor, the Murdoch Mysteries and things like that. Obviously, yeah. That's a different creative expression then, because you're working off someone else's kind of, you know, ideas. You're kind of inhabiting that. And as you said, yes. you're gone and all that. Like, why, like, which one? I know the answer is probably going to be both, but which do you prefer? Your own creative process where you can say, I'm going to make my own thing and all the stress, the pressure is going to come with that. Or do you prefer to take on the other roles in the different shows and just say, you know what? All I have to do is perform in front of a camera first.
Right. It's a different muscle to operate from the position of your own machine versus operating inside the machine of somebody else. It's a different muscle and it's a different experience. Having, you know, completed this experience with Linus, I wouldn't want to trade that for anything in the world. I learned so much and it has so much value to me, even though it existed in someone else's machine and I was coming in and doing this thing. Does it have more merit than my own expression? I learned so much. So I think it is both. But the one thing I know for certain is I can't just be in other people's machines. I absolutely have to continue to create and generate my own work and perform my own work. Otherwise, I will suffocate.
Yeah, I 100% get that. That's why I do my own stuff on the side,
yes,
as well as having a full-time job. Because otherwise, if you just do the same thing day in, day out for other people, you go mad.
Yeah. Yeah. I need to do this for me. And also, you know, however you want to talk, the muses, the ideas, whatever your language is, they can be pretty insistent. And I've learned to have that conversation. I want to be in good relationship with them.
And like, what's the next project you're going to work on now, David, at the moment? Or is it top secret and you can't tell us? I can see a smile on your face. There it is there. Can't tell you what's going to happen next.
I actually just finished writing a new TV pilot that I had been working on, which is loosely based on Fagnificent, actually.
Mike, we're in the wrong feckin' business here. Like, Dave is just here going, I'm just going to sit down here and write a TV pilot there in my spare time. Anyway, that's done. I'm off to something
else. No, you're in the wrong business.
Well, no, like, I just wrote it, and some producery types are looking at it, and so it's a pitch that's in the world. It doesn't, you know, it's all just talk and, oh, that, you know, whatever. But that's good. So I'm in a little bit of a quiet space right now where I am contemplating what the next thing might be that's coming in.
When you're in a period like this, then, David, are you kind of sitting there saying, I'm going to wait for something to happen? Or are you saying, no, I'm going to go out and I'm going to make it happen myself?
This is always, as an artist, the most uncomfortable period for me. The in-between, and I think it's a challenging period for most artists. But it's also the most valuable. And sometimes it's just an opportunity for you to go out and live your life. Like, just go have some experiences, go fill your tank, go see some stuff. Don't worry about it. Come back when you're ready. Do you know what I mean? It's so it's like, and but all the time it feels like there's fire ants all over your body and you're just like, what is it going to be? What am I going to do? What am I going
to
love?
I need to do something.
I when I was younger, I was seeing a therapist, and I was railing on about a friend of mine who had just exited a relationship and just blasted into another one. And I was, how could they do this? What have they learned? They're not like, they need some time to decompress. Like, how could they be like this? And then she just sort of did one of those therapist silences where she sort of, you know, held the room and looked at me for a minute. And you know, something blood curdling is coming. And she said, well, what are you like after you finish a creative project? And I said, well, I just jump right into the next.
In other words, you just answered your own question.
Yeah, and then I just got my bag and I left because I'm like, I don't want to do that anymore. But it was a great, again, shot across my bow. It was something to pay attention to. You know, like, this in-between is uncomfortable and it's itchy. You have to pay attention to what might be flirting with you, but you really need to go out and have a life for a time.
Yeah.
And I'll say this too, the same thing with writer's block. Writer's block is nothing more than an invitation for you to put your stuff down and go have a life for a bit and come back to it. Yeah. This idea that we can now hit a button and AI is gonna solve our writer's block is so abhorrent to me, because that is not the creative process. That's a whole other conversation.
I did find some really interesting things to help with creative block, which is, for someone like me that's a designer, it's the same thing as writer's block. And essentially, it's like a pack of cards that someone's created.
Yes.
And then you just shuffle them up and then you pick one out and you can just spark an idea off of it.
Yeah.
So sometimes things like that can help. But yes, I fully agree. Sometimes when you get writer's block, you just need to switch off, because the experiences that you have whilst just switched off normally will inspire you to continue on in maybe a different direction, the same direction, etc.
100%. And like those cards, like those visual cues, like there was one really specific instance where I was writing a play, could not figure out the ending, furious, up against a wall, livid. I just felt like I had been betrayed. You know, you led me to this place and now you've abandoned me. How dare you? Raging. So I go out for a walk and I go to a CD store again, you know.
Oh, God, David, that's twice. That's
hey, at least
twice.
It's not a vinyl store.
I'll own it. I will own it.
David, no one's actually gone beyond one, right? You're at two. If you get to three, the interview's over immediately.
Okay, noted. And I was flipping through some DVDs, and I saw an image.
Oh, geez, the DVDs. No one even watches DVDs anymore. That's the turn.
No, I knew that we didn't know what was. We didn't know.
At least it's not video disc or Betamax or something.
Yeah, 100%. I'm not like, and then I popped my beta tape in my.
Don't you give me that side eye like that.
I saw this picture on the front of this DVD. And much like in one of those cards, the image, I was like, oh my God, I know. I got it. And I ran home frantic. Because I had gotten the inspiration. And so again, like anything, sometimes you just, you know, go do something, go look at something new. You have those prompt cards, like all of that. It's your process. Everyone works differently. You figure it out.
I think it could be Nick Meyer, but I could be getting wrong. But I remember he spoke about when he was writing and things like that. And he said, how am I supposed to explain to my producer that I've been sitting in the bath for 2 hours staring at my toes, but this is part of the creative process when I try to get something together?
100%. 100%. 100%. And we don't... Process can be tedious to talk about.
Yeah.
Because everyone's process is different. But in this sort of like hyper-results-oriented society, we have to acknowledge that there is a process. And that there is work involved, and that it's not just, I'm going to sit down and write a bestseller on my first draft, because that is not the path. Maybe you get one page that is out of this world amazing, right? So, like on the go, it's just like, it's genius. I'm amazing.
So when you're working on something, do you struggle to switch off?
No, because I'm always kind of on.
Okay, so then that leads me to my next question is let's say you're wandering around the supermarket and all of a sudden you get an idea. I have an app on my phone, which I talk into constantly. People think I'm mad because I come up with, I was swimming the other day and I now have to have it on my watch. So when I can be swimming and get halfway down the pool and go, that's what I need to do. And if I don't put it in there, I will forget. So do you have a process for dealing with things like that?
100%. I travel with a notebook. And if I'm the dude who at a dinner party will be like, will you excuse me for just a moment and go and write something down and come back? I will stop what I'm doing. And if I'm without a notebook, I will take out my phone and I will voice memo the thing.
Good old
voice
memo. And
that is a critical part of the creative process for me, because not only does it demonstrate that you're paying attention and you're listening, but it's proactive. And I always look at it like, if you were in a bar and you saw like super sexy someone and you have a little chat and they're like, I want to give you my number. Would you trust yourself to remember the number that they give you? Or would you write that down in the moment? Like, that's how critical the information is. Yeah. And I'm always like, I'm going to write that number down because I want to make this call. So that's how I always treat those asides. Absolutely. Like in the pool, wherever it is, get it.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
You're not. My friends are used to it. My friends are used to it. And if it's something that one of them actually says specifically, I'll always say, I'm going to take that and use it. Thank you. And let them know.
Just like you said, you're going to steal the name of the autobiography I gave you earlier on as well.
No. I've already said that this is a partnership now.
David, I have to ask you the Adam Driver question. Do you find it hard? You're there going, what is the Adam Driver question? You're there going, fascinated by what he's going to ask me here. Do you find it hard to watch back your own performances?
Yes, but not as Linus.
And is that because you're in prosthetics?
Yes. I can watch Linus really objectively because it is a different thing. I can't explain it. I don't know. Like when it's my face, it's like, oh my God, someone get me out of here. I think I ruined everything. Which is kind of my MO on anything. So it's like, I think I just ruined the whole, I ruined it. Was that me? I did it.
Sorry, hang on. We've actually got the title of the sequel autobiography, which is David Benjamin Tomlinson, I've Ruined Everything. There it is. Look at that. My money making machine right here.
Now I'm going to write two. I've got a There's something about Linus and the observing of Linus, because so much of the prosthetics journey on Discovery was very much a learning process for me. And I'm not trying to pun here, but it was a discovery process. Like, so I could look at what was happening, and because I'm inhabiting art, yeah, and living and breathing inside of art and then watching it outside, I can look at it technically and think, okay, a little bit, I can see, yes, more of that, less of that. And so it becomes a little bit more clinical. And I sort of always give myself a little something to think about in the next time I'm at bat. And yeah, but it's easier with Linus. He's so handsome, our Linus.
Well, good news for you. Andrew Robinson, who plays the wonderful Garrick, gave exactly the same answer.
Oh, amazing.
He has exactly, he can't watch himself back, but when he says Garrick, it's fine.
Totally fine. It's, yeah, it truly is another person. It's almost like I forget that that's me, which is great, which means I can enjoy the show a lot more.
And did you grow up as a Star Trek fan, David?
I grew up as an overall nerd, I would say. Star Trek was definitely in the palette, but I like horror movies, sci-fi, fantasy, all of it. Next Generation was my Trek show that I, as a teen, that I watched and you know, loved. Doctor Who, was a very big Doctor Who fan, although I didn't, you know, I'm living in this rural town and I did not know the legacy of the character or anything about regeneration.
Yep.
So my Doctor Who was Tom Baker, who I was like, I wish I had my, like, we all want Doctor Who to pop in and say, solve the problem. And when he regenerated into Peter Davidson, I just looked at the TV and I was like, what just happened? And there was no internet, there was no fan base I could consult about. Like, I had no idea, because this was just on a public broadcaster that we got with our antenna. And I was like, And then I stopped watching.
To be honest with you, I did exactly the same thing after after David Tennant. I just just couldn't watch Doctor Who after that.
Was it Matt Smith was after David Tennant?
Yeah, I watched some of the Matt Smith stuff, but I've tried to watch stuff again and I just can't. David Tennant would always be my doctor.
I was particularly captivated by Capaldi's doctor, because it got back to that wild-eyed, older, crazy man, which I think is such an interesting...
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree. I don't like David Capaldi, so that just...
Oh, well.
Just a personal opinion.
David, because I was having a random rip through your our Instagram account earlier on, as you do, I noticed that you went in 2002, you were at a kind of a cinema marathon of all the 13 Star Trek movies. Jesus, thank God. Otherwise, I was there going, whose Instagram account was I looking at there?
Was it last summer or the summer before? A friend and I, he has a home theater in his basement, and this came out of the pandemic. This was one of my bubble people. So he has a home theater in his basement. So we decided one summer that we would watch one a week, the entire film franchise of everything, which I had never done in close succession before. And it was amazing.
Which movie stood out for you and kind of rewatching them that way?
I really appreciated one more than I did at the time. And it's like, wow, there's a lot of really... I love so much of what's happening here. I get that the pace is a little slower, but there was something really interesting. For like sentimental favorite, what was the one that blew my mind? Five, six, six, It's not Undiscovered Country. No. What's the one? Khan, Spock, Voyage.
Brilliant.
Home. What's Undiscovered Country is 5.
No, and then Final Frontier is 5. The Undiscovered and then Country is 6. Country.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That blew my mind. Undiscovered Country. I was like, what? I loved it. Oh, wait. No, that's right. 5 is the one with Cyborg.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
So the one after. Amazing. Yeah. Christopher Plummer is a Klingon. That's
yes.
the one.
Star Trek 6. Yeah.
Blew my socks off. And then there was the Next Gen films, the ones that the Alice Krieg as the Borg Queen.
Yeah.
Still, I'm just like, one of the all-time great sci-fi performances. And then there's something unbelievably charming about the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, that first movie. There's something really winning about it. The
you
cast,
mean that movie right there?
That movie right there. Yeah. There's something really spirited, and that he assembled such a beautiful, beautiful cast who are walking that amazing line of having a foot in sort of respect and what came before, but also introducing a new vibe and just amazing.
A new look. It had a different look. I found out the other day that they've furnished a lot of the set from IKEA. What? So the transporter pad at the top, there's like a ring of like transparent plastic bars. They're actually soap dishes from IKEA. Yeah, it's a whole behind the scenes thing about how they got that.
I did not know that.
IKEA, and they've just flipped that upside down and drilled a hole in it and stuck it on the wall. And I love that. Okay. That's brilliant.
Yeah, that kind of effortless production design is when you see stuff like that, and it's like,
Enterprise
wow.
Was furnished from IKEA. There you go.
So simple and so effective.
Yeah.
David, I'm going to ask you a really lousy question again because, well, that's what we do. if you were to pick one episode or one movie of Star Trek and you were to say to someone who's never seen it, this is what I think you should watch that'll get you into it, what would it be?
It's for sentimental reasons. It has to be the episode of Next Generation that blew my mind as a teenager. And I don't even know the name of it. It's the poker game time loop one.
Oh yeah, cause and effect.
Cause and effect.
Why
I watched it as a kid and I was just like, this is possibly the greatest hour of television in history. Just the struggling to figure out the loop and then Data communicating to himself through the car. Like it's just, and then like you, oh. Yeah.
I love it. And how did the role then for Discovery come up? I'm just kind of curious as well. It's obviously a role that has a lot of prosthetics and things like that. Had you been used to wearing prosthetics leading up to the role as Linus on Disco? No, this was all new.
No, it was all new. Season one, the Klingons, that was really a trial by fire. It was a real unexpected turn and opportunity. And it was just like my first time on a really big set like that, like a big science fiction show. I'm in this, the Klingon prosthetic is easily one of the most challenging prosthetics I've ever had to wear. And it was like, that was my first one. And it was a lot. It taught me a lot.
Why was it a difficult one to wear?
It was very heavy, and there was the shape of the head. I had to wear like a foam bowl on the back of my head to support the back of the.
Right. Oh, yeah, because they're very elongated, aren't they?
Back. Yeah. And the wardrobe was stunning. The armor was stunning, but it was very cumbersome to get into, and it was all, you know, and I'm not used to prosthetic work. I often wondered what, you know, I used to watch like special features on the VHS tapes when I was, please don't end the interview, please, as a kid. And I would watch the actors getting face cast. Cause I mean, I grew up in the age of practical effects and I have so much affection for that wizardry. And I was like, what's it like to get your head cast, that, you know, and when I finally had my head cast or my life cast, and then got the prosthetic on, it was like, oh my God, this is what it is. And it is all the things that you think it might be. And there's a whole other piece about your own survival that you need to sort of get on top of. So off my Klingon experience, an email came in at the start of season two that just said, we'd like to offer David the role of Linus the Saurian. And that was it. I had to look it up. I didn't know what a Saurian was. And then I saw that there had been another appearance, the very back of the movie. And I was wondering about the design and what they would do. And then I walked in for the test and I saw him on the counter and I just kind of gasped. He was just one of the most beautiful, handsome things I had seen. And there was a very interesting intersection about that design and me that happened as a result.
So how much, did you have any input on the design?
Oh no, good Lord, no.
Nothing at
all. That's all Frederick and Neville Page. You know, it comes done. It's built to my face, but it comes like, listen, this is the guy.
I've seen the time lapse of you being turned into Linus.
Yes, yeah. a two hour process.
That's not bad.
When you're in the room, then David, is there anyone else in the room getting their prosthetics done at the same time as you, or is it just you on your own inside the room?
It depends who's shooting that day. Often Doug will be in the room at the same time as me, and so we'll banter and chat. And you know, Doug is very much found family to me. Like, we're very much two peas in a pod, so we laugh a lot together. But anyone who's getting a prosthetic applied can be in the trailer. But I always work consistently with the same artists every season. It's kind of like they're my anchor.
And like, when you would speak to Doug, did he kind of give any kind of words of advice? Because obviously he's, you know, the ultimate man behind the kind of makeup and all the roles that he's done over the years. Like, did he kind of impart anything to you that you kind of held on to since all, you know, over the years, say, of working alongside him?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and let's consider for a moment, someone offers you a job and says, we'd like to offer you this job. And you're going to learn how to do it alongside the best in the world. No pressure. Doug is a remarkable ally, and he was incredibly supportive. And along the way, if I had a question, he had an answer. And sometimes he would ask me questions. Like, very early, he said, how does Linus walk? Which sort of, you know, made me realize, right, that the mask extends past the prosthetic down through the whole body. And throughout our whole journey together, he was always there for me, and I was there for him, like emotionally and like so many, and just watching him work on set, I learned so much. He was he's a beautiful, beautiful human being. And I also learned the power of holding space with someone, because often Doug and I would be the only people on set in a heavy prosthetic, and everyone else between takes is on their cell phones and eating food. And, you know, we just.
And you're there with a smoothie and a straw.
And then sometimes, you know, often we just sit together and hold hands, or we'd sit together side by side in silence, but we're sharing and holding space for each other because we know what the other person is going through. And there is a ridiculous amount of power in that, and a real source of strength when you're like, I'm not the only person in this. And if he saw my energy flag, he would always come over and give me a hug. And if I saw his energy flag, I would always give him a hug. And we were, you know, he's amazing. He's amazing.
And like, when you say in those situations, David, as you said, like in between takes and people are kind of on their phones eating things and things like that, what's going on in your head in that time then? Like, you can't do what they're doing and you're just kind of waiting around for the next shot. Are you kind of there going, my God, this prosthetic is so heavy, I just want to get out of it? Or what's going on in your head in these situations?
That's part of the psychological piece I referred to earlier. The big management piece for me is that you cannot live in your discomfort. If you live in your discomfort, it's game over. You're done before you get started. So you have to dwell in other places. So you're like, yes, my job is going to be discomfort. I'm going to be uncomfortable. but what else? I'm going to find fun things to think about, or I'm going to sleep. My big thing is, where can I lean up against a wall and pass out? And because I'd often leave my eyes in on set, I would just sort of, you know, get very still because you're conserving your energy and whatnot. Yeah. And I would close my eyes, but it looks like Linus is still awake. So there's a number of times where they had called everyone back to set, but I didn't catch it because I was asleep. And then they had to come scurrying back and be like, oh. And so then it was, you know, if you came up to me and I wasn't moving, as you put your hand on my leg and, you know, David, are you? Yeah, I'm here. What is it?
So he's, you know, they like sunglasses.
Yes, they look, it's like looking through dark purple sunglasses. So everything is a dark purple hue, which was great on the bridge when there were those giant flashes of light. And at the end of the day, everyone would be like, oh, my eyes are so sore. And I'm so, no problem. There's no problem. I've got for me.
Sunglasses on, it's fine.
David, who were some of your kind of co-workers that, outside of Doug, who you would have kind of interacted with most? I know, obviously, Rachel is a good friend of yours now as well. Anyone else?
Oh, absolutely. Orville, who played Lieutenant Christopher, Patrick, Lieutenant Reese. They were always up there. They were always up to for just like a bit of comedy on the bridge, or like just, hey, how you doing? Checking in. Rachel, absolutely. Whenever she was there. But and then Doug would be like, those were my. Because Krista, and especially in this last season, Linus was fully promoted to the bridge. So Orville and I were very close to each other, and so we had a great time.
I'm kind of always conscious of the fact that like there's a lot of behind the scenes videos that you'd see of the Discovery crew on the bridge, and it looks like everyone just has a great time in kind of what they're doing. Like, is that, again, I know it's going to be a stupid question, is it an accurate portrayal of what the atmosphere is like on the set? Like, does everyone kind of get on? Is it a great kind of place to be when you're there?
Yeah, absolutely. A show like this is such heavy lifting for everybody. But there's a real buoyancy to this crew and this cast. And I think a lot of what I'm going to miss the most about this experience is those between the take moments, like watching Mary Wiseman do something hilarious. You know, she'll just start singing a song or do something, you know, quirky and wonderful, and or palling around with Orville, or, you know, the things that we do in the green room area, just as a cast, the way that we'd laugh together. Like, it was an incredible intersection of like-minded artists and a really positive community, which is not to say that there weren't like closer bonds in different areas, but it was never clicky. Like, inside the beautiful weave of that community, we all bolstered and supported and loved each other. And there are hard days. Like, you get to hour 14 and you're like, I'm gonna lose my mind, but there's always a laugh to find. And you have to remember where you are. I'm on the bridge of the Discovery. This should never be tedious. This view should never be boring. Take a look around you. You know, in my dark moments, you know, which they're inevitable, but it's just like, take a look around you right now. Remember where you are. Pull yourself together.
And then how have you... Sorry, go on, Mike.
How do you cope with the prosthetics? Do you find it claustrophobic, or... do you just get on with it, or do you
just get on with it?
Because I know some people really struggle with full face prosthetics and they get very claustrophobic. And
that's not me. I was very curious about how I would react in the life cast, because I can be claustrophobic in some ways, but I was so comfortable in my life cast process that I fell asleep in the middle of the process. I just relaxed. It was very, and I guess this happens sometimes, but, you know, we discussed, they're like, if you get in distress, you give us the thumbs up. And if you need help, it's thumbs down. And if you're okay, it's thumbs up. And so I'm sitting there and the goo and the layers have all gone on and it's heating
straws
up
your nose.
They didn't. I was a little bummed out, to be fair. I was like, that's the iconic thing. And they're like, we're just gonna keep it clear. And I was just like, oh, right, fine.
You have to.
They took such good care of me though. And we had this discussion, and so I'm sitting there and it's heating up and I can feel it all cooking. And it's just like, The next thing I know, I've keeled over and I feel all their hands on me and they're like, David, are you all right? And I'm like, yes, I'm fine. And then so, you know, they didn't race to take it off. And at the end of it, I was like, I'm so sorry. Again, I think I ruin it. I said, I'm so sorry for that. I have a weird comfort with it, but admittedly, because I start my process 2 hours before the shooting day, so it's on a long time. If I'm doing a full day, around hour 12 or 13 tends to be my expiry time, where simply my work becomes managing my own survival in a very specific way. Like, who knows what I'm doing? I'm just trying to get through.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
and I'm David, like, obviously... Obviously, you know, you grew up as a nerd, you're in Star Trek, and it's an absolutely incredible experience. How have you felt your connection with the Star Trek fan base itself?
So beautiful. I went to my first convention when was it? We were still in pandemic-y time, so maybe what year is this? 2024?
21.
So I think 2021, 2021, 2022 in there. And it was a time where everything was still very fragmented and challenging. And I remember getting to the convention, and basically the thing that everyone said was, "Welcome to the family," which at that time was a really profound thing to hear, given how splintered everything felt. And he was this amazing family welcoming. There was so much enthusiasm for Linus and so much conversation about Linus. And it just was like, and as an artist, it's always great. You're always like, oh, I'd love for people to like, you know, I hope people like this, but I have to do it for me, but it'd be nice. It's nice that people found something about this character, that the same kind of delight that I found in playing him, that translated. So I'm grateful to the community for welcoming me and being so positive and sharing their stories. It's amazing.
And in terms of, say, you've obviously given us a lot of kind of examples of, say, your time on the set and things like that. Is there any one time specifically that stands out for you, say, working on Discovery, that you kind of will cling to and kind of always kind of keep in your head? Now, it's very possible it might be something that has happened in season 5 that we're not aware of yet and things like that. So you can't ruin too much.
Fair. I don't know. It is... You know, like, I know that Linus is a small part of the Discovery journey, but it was a huge adventure for me.
Yeah.
And so the whole experience is, there are ups and there are downs. You know, I found myself on a black sand beach in Iceland getting vaporized when I played the Beetlejuicean. I was sweltering in Toronto out at the Bluffs when we were shooting. It was like 110 degree weather, and we were shooting some Kelpian things for the second season. And I just thought, this is the hottest I think I've ever been in my entire life. The joys of the laughter, the gifts of all the friendships that I've made, the laughs that we've shared. It's hard to pick a singular moment. It's all just it's all life, right? It's like an unfolding journey. It's hard to pick one thing. But
and what was it like the day you had to say goodbye to the character in Star Trek? Obviously, there's always a possibility Linus could come back, but what was it like the day you had to say goodbye? If you don't want to talk about it, David, as well, that's also fine.
Or I can talk about it. Did you get to say goodbye? Because obviously it was
Yes.
Cancelled abruptly.
Yes. So I got to say goodbye to the character, and it was very moving to know this is my, as far as I know, my last time in this space that has, we've traveled together and that I've learned so much from. And I was surprisingly emotional, and I'm like a still waters run deep kind of fellow. I'm not like a heart on my sleeve kind of guy, but I was like teary on set, and there was a lot going on that I can't talk about. I'm trying to talk about, anyways. Yes. But I was grateful for the goodbye that I had, and grateful for being able, because when I got the news of the cancellation, my first thought was, I'm not going to be able to be in, just have a proper goodbye inside that head. And I know it's going to sound very actory and, you know, potentially silly, but I have a big attachment to that face and being on the inside of it. And whatever that energy is, that is Linus, that, you know. And so having the opportunity to have like a moment together in the trailer where I was like, this is it, buddy. You know, this is it. I was grateful for, and he still travels with me.
I was about to ask, do you think, will you ever have a kind of, you know, say a mask of Linus somewhere in your house? Or do you think, no, that's completely, completely mad. I'm not going to do such a thing at all. How dare you suggest?
No, I absolutely would. Yeah.
So you would happily do a
Mom, I get it together. You can do it. You can get the word out.
You're going to do an Anson Mount, because he wanted his uniform and badge from the first two episodes of season two of Discovery, the gold.
Yeah.
And he was told no. So when they went up for auction, he bought them.
Oh, that's amazing. I didn't know that. Oh, way to go.
Yeah, this is Anson Mount facts. We're giving all the Anson Mount facts in this episode altogether.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, I love that moxie. I have, you know, I, of course, everyone wants their badge.
Yeah.
But those things are removed the second.
Yeah, I mean, when I was talking to Boo, right? They were like, they're under armed guard. There's someone behind you the moment that you are, and they will take them off of you.
Worse.
Yeah. For me, the emotionality and the connection is really the mask. It's having been in that head and spent so much time in that head. And it's a head that, as far as I know, I'm the only person to have worn. It's a very singular connection. And that's where the meaning is. The I'm less fussy about the word, the, you know, outfit.
And David, kind of going back then to something we discussed at the very start, in terms of, say, as you said, if you take on roles, you do roles, then when you're finished, you kind of move on, you kind of put it behind you and things like that.
Yeah.
If you had a chance to come back as Linus in some shape or form, because, you know, there's always kind of possibility in the Star Trek universe, these things can happen.
Starfleet Academy.
Would you take the chance? Or would you say it depends on what the character is like? Would you rather have something meaningful, or if they said it would just be a guest walk on part in the background, would you take it? Or would you say, do you know what? No, I had a good few years with Linus in that way and it ended well, and I'm happy to leave it like that.
You know, like, work is work. So there's that. But if there was, I mean, I don't think if someone came to me and said, we'd like to do something with Linus, I would find it impossible to say no. I would find it impossible to say no. But at the same time, if someone said, we'd like to put you in a different face, that would be equally as exciting.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, now I'm like a friend of mine who works in the wardrobe, who worked in the wardrobe truck on Discovery when I was sort of on my last day. And we were sort of talking about it because she'd been there since the first season. We were talking about our journey together. And she said, you know, it's like, She said, like, Linus has been your university. And she said, so you can get out and, you know, you can go do things, like show what you can do because of this experience. And I guess so that's where my mindset is. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, I've learned so much and I've, you know, I've had this really amazing experience and I'd like to build on that and show what I can do now as a result of this amazing journey.
So Alex Kurtzman, you heard it here first. We need more people in different prosthetics.
Yeah. Mike, do you have any other questions or do you want to ask David that awkward last question that
thinking about it. So on that note, is there a species...
Is this the awkward question?
No. We've got one more. Yeah, okay. This has just come to me whilst talking about other prosthetics. Is there a species you would love to play? Whether it's Ferengi or Klingon, well, you've done Klingon, but you know.
I would love to be a Vulcan. I think I would serve amazing Vulcan, but once they see your face, it's over. So I'm unhappy for that not to happen just yet.
Plus, you have to shave your eyebrows.
Yeah, well, I'm fine with that. I'll do it. Yeah, I Vulcan is the most iconic one because it is so iconic. But I'm also interested in new faces and things we haven't seen yet, and new prosthetics. I think that would be the opportunity to contribute. I mean, this is the thing that also hounded me in the beginning was I'm contributing to canon and sort of the Saurian species in a way that I have to be responsible about. And it was freaking me out a bit. I'm like, how does this character behave? And I did some movement work with a movement coach and I watched a bunch of reptilian reference footage and got a lot of inspiration from that. And actually it was my first day on set and we were shooting the elevator sneeze gag.
I love that scene.
I was terrified. I was terrified, but this was like Linus's big debut on set. Rachel was there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first day I met Rachel and we were in the elevator. And so Suniqua, we were rehearsing the scene and it was late. Like they'd been shooting all day and then they had brought me in around dinner and it was like midnight. So it was like everyone was a bit punchy, like, you know, silly and fun. And so we rehearsed the scene. And in the scene, I had to make kind of a noise indicating my sore throat because they hadn't endowed Linus with speech at this point. And no one had talked to me about the noise to make. So I had like watched all my reference footage and done all of my work. And I was stressing like, David, you're going to ruin everything, right? And so Suniqua comes in and she asked me the question about my throat and I just turned to her and I make the noise that I had. And Suniqua's eyes went like, ooga. And she just said, oh, it is going to be a long night with this one. And then everyone started laughing. And then I felt Doug's hand on my shoulder and there was instant like this joyful, celebratory vibe. And then all of a sudden at the back of my head, I heard a voice that said, oh, I've got this. I know exactly what this is. And it was Linus, right? Like that joy sort of scraped away the stress and Linus kind of emerged in that moment. And it was pretty powerful and amazing. Why am I talking about this? Did I just...
Oh, who cares? It was a brilliant story. I absolutely loved listening to it.
I had a point. What was the question? Oh, Lord.
We were talking about what other species you'd like to play. That was the initial question. And we completely segued into this. Oh. And I was all... Oh.
Yeah, yes. So off the back... So yes. So the joy comes in and Linus comes in and then that sort of... And then I sort of contribute in a way that is authentic based on the bedrock of my research and all of that work, but also something that's much freer and inhabits and joy. And I think I feel like having the opportunity to like do the same thing with a different species that we haven't seen before would be a very cool, very cool thing.
And then well, I'll just sneeze all over Sean. And then you got to sneeze all over poor Sean Affleck.
all over, and my teeth flew out on one of the sneezes. Again, it was like a devastating. It was just I did a real big sneeze, and then there was a clink, 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 and my teeth hit the actor and shattered on the floor. And then, of course, I was like, David, you ruined everything. I've just broken $1,000. The prosthetics team were amazing. They rushed in. They're like, everyone's laughing. The crew's hysterical. It was, and the prosthetics team brought in the second pair of teeth, and everything was fine. And it was this really bright, auspicious debut for Linus. Like in that first night of shooting, there was so much laughter and there was so much light that it was like I had this feeling like there's gonna be more of this guy.
Well, we have one last question then.
Oh Lord. Okay.
You won't have to
Oh.
think about it. It's really easy. Trust me.
Okay.
David Benjamin Tomlinson.
Okay, yes.
Let's try that again.
Yes.
David Benjamin Tomlinson, what does Star Trek mean to you?
It's an interesting question to answer given the last 6 years of my life, and now I'm kind of looking at it in the rearview mirror. Star Trek to me is hope and laughter and art and community and joy and discovery.
That's awesome. I love that. Well, David, thank you very much for coming on the show. This has been incredible. I can't wait to see more Linus in season 5.
You will.
Yep.
You will.
Other than that, for everyone watching and listening, thank you very much for tuning into this week's episode with the wonderful David Benjamin Tomlinson and my wonderful co-host, Sho Hurley. Until next time, live long and prosper.